His beard was neatly pointed, and his hair long, frozen into a solid sculptural mass. He was still wearing several heavy layers of thermal clothing. Clavaine knelt closer and read the name tag above the man's heart. Andrew Iverson. Ring a bell? A moment went by while Galliana established a link to the rest of the conjoiners, ferreting the name out of some database. Yes, one of the missing. Seems he was a climatologist with an interest in terraforming techniques. Clavaine nodded shrewdly. That figures, with all the microorganisms I've seen in this place. Well, the trillion-dollar question. How do you think he got in there? I think he climbed in, Galliana said, and nodded at something which Clavaine had missed, almost tucked away beneath the man's shoulder. Clavaine reached into the gap, his finger brushing against the rock-hard fabric of Iverson's outfit. A catheter vanished into the man's forearm, where he had cut away a square of fabric. The catheter's black feed line reached back into the cabinet, vanishing into a socket at the rear. You're saying he killed himself? He must have put something in there that would stop his heart. Then he probably flushed out his blood and replaced it with glycerol or something similar to prevent ice crystals forming in his cells. It would have taken some automation to make it work, but I'm sure everything he needed was here. Clavaine thought back to what he knew about the cryonic immersion techniques that had been around a century or so earlier. They left something to be desired now, but back then they had not been much of an advance over mummification. When he sank that catheter into himself, he couldn't have been certain we'd ever find him, Clavaine remarked. Which would still have been preferable to suicide. Yes, but the thoughts that must have gone through his head. Knowing he had to kill himself first to stand a chance of living again, and then hope someone else stumbled on Diadem. You made a harder choice than that once. Yes, but at least I wasn't alone when I made it. Iverson's body was astonishingly well-preserved, Clavaine thought. The skin tissue looked almost intact, even if it had a deathly, granite-like color. The bones of his face had not ruptured under the strain of the temperature drop. Bacterial processes had stopped dead. All in all, things could have been a lot worse. We shouldn't leave him like this, Galliana said, pushing the locker so that it began to slide back into the wall. I don't think he cares much about that now, Clavaine said. No, you don't understand. He mustn't warm, not even to the ambient temperature of the room. Otherwise, we won't be able to wake him up. It took 5 days to bring him back to consciousness. The decision to reanimate had not been taken lightly. It had only been arrived at after intense discussion among the conjoined, debates in which Clavaine participated to the best of his ability. Iverson, they all agreed, could probably be resurrected with current conjoiner methods. In situ scans of his mind had revealed preserved synaptic structures that a scaffold of machines could coax back toward consciousness. However, since they had not yet identified the cause of the madness which had killed Iverson's colleagues, and the evidence was pointing towards some kind of infectious agent, Iverson would be kept on the surface, reborn on the same world where he had died. They had, however, moved him, shuttling him halfway across the world back to the main base. Clavaine had traveled with the corpse, marveling at the idea that this solid chunk of man-shaped ice, tainted admittedly with a few vital impurities, would soon be a breathing, thinking human being with memories and feelings. To him, it seemed astonishing that this was possible, that so much latent structure had been preserved across the decades. Even more astonishing was that the infusions of tiny machines that the conjoiners were brewing would be able to stitch together damaged cells and kickstart them back to life. And out of that inert loom of frozen brain structure, a thing that was at this moment nothing more than a fixed geometric entity like a finely eroded piece of rock, something as malleable as consciousness would emerge. But the conjoiners were blasé at the prospect, viewing Iverson the way expert picture restorers might view a damaged old master. Yes, there would be difficulties ahead, work that would require great skill, but nothing to lose sleep over. Except, Clavaine reminded himself, none of them slept anyway. While the others were working to bring Iverson back to life, Clavaine wandered the outskirts of the base, trying to get a better feel for what it must have been like in the last days. The debilitating mental illness must have been terrifying, as it struck even those who might have stood some chance of developing some kind of counteragent to it. Perhaps in the old days, when the base had been under the stewardship of the von Neumann machines, something might have been done. But in the end, it must have been like trying to crack a particularly tricky algebra problem while growing steadily more drunk. Losing first the ability to focus sharply, then to focus on the problem at all, and then to remember what was so important about it anyway. The labs in the main complex had an abandoned look to them. Experiments half finished. Notes on the wall scrawled in ever more incoherent handwriting. Down in the lower levels, the transport bays and storage areas, it was almost as if nothing had happened. Equipment was still neatly racked, surface vehicles neatly parked, and with the base subsystems back on, the place was bathed in light and not so cold as to require extra clothing. It was quite therapeutic, too. The conjoiners had not extended their communicational fields into these regions, so Clavaine's mind was mercifully isolated again, freed of the clamor of other voices. Despite that, he was still tempted by the idea of spending some time outdoors. With that in mind, he found an airlock, one that must have been added late in the base's history, as it was absent from the blueprints. There was no membrane stretched across this one. If he stepped through it, he would be outside as soon as the doors cycled, with no more protection than the clothes he was wearing now. He considered going back into the base proper to find a membrane suit, but by the time he did that, the mood, the urge to go outside, would be gone. Clavaine noticed a locker. Inside, to his delight, was a rack of old-style suits such as Setterholm had been wearing. They looked brand new, alloy neck rings gleaming. Racked above each was a bulbous helmet. He experimented until he found a suit that fit him, then struggled with the various latches and seals that coupled the suit parts together. Even when he thought he had donned the suit properly, the airlock detected that one of his gloves wasn't latched correctly. It refused to let him outside until he reversed the cycle and fixed the problem. But then he was outside. And it was glorious. He walked around the base until he found his bearings, and then, always ensuring that the base was in view and that his air supply was adequate, he set off across the ice. Above, Diadem's sky was a deep enameled blue, and the ice, though fundamentally white, seemed to contain in itself a billion nuances of pale turquoise, pale aquamarine, even hints of the palest of pinks. Beneath his feet he imagined the crack-like networks of the worms, threading down for hundreds of meters. And he imagined the worms themselves, wriggling through that network, responding to and secreting chemical scent trails. The worms themselves were biologically simple, almost dismayingly so, but that network was a vast, intricate thing. It hardly mattered that the traffic along it, the to-and-fro motions of the worms as they went about their lives, was so agonizingly slow. The worms, after all, had endured longer than human comprehension. They had seen people come and go in an eye-blink. He walked on until he arrived at the crevasse where he had found Setterholm. They had long since removed Setterholm's body, of course, but the experience had imprinted itself deeply on Clavaine's mind. He found it easy to relive the moment at the lip of the crevasse when he had first seen the end of Setterholm's arm. At the time, he had told himself that there must be worse places to die, surrounded by beauty that was so pristine, so utterly untouched by human influence. Now, the more that he thought about it, the more that Setterholm's death played on his mind, he wondered if there could be any worse place. It was undeniably beautiful, but it was also crushingly dead, crushingly oblivious to life. Setterholm must have felt himself draining away, soon to become as inanimate as the palace of ice that was to become his tomb. Clavaine thought about it for many more minutes, enjoying the silence and the solitude and the odd awkwardness of the suit. He thought back to the way Setterholm had been found, and his mind niggled at something not quite right, a detail that had not seemed wrong at the time, but that now troubled him. It was Setterholm's helmet. He remembered the